Hello, hello. It is March 7th-ish. You'll hear this probably around the 12th. Welcome to Coder Radio. Today I have a great interview with Nick Proud over in London town. It's not really in London, but you know, Americans think it's all London, don't they? All the city. He is the CTO over at Nexbotics, a robotic process automation firm that uses AI to do all that RPA stuff that all the big enterprises are just so interested in right now. He says it better than I do, so I'll just let him speak for himself. Good conversation. We do veer into the Rust side of life a little because the crab and yes, we've got crabs. We have a terrible crab infestation. It's pinching, it's itching, it's horrible. Apparently the crab people are everywhere. Lots of love, crabbies. But first, we do have a bit of housekeeping and one quick hit game review. So here we go. The Google issues, God willing, are solved. So this should appear in your Google podcast, YouTube Music, whatever it's called, properly at the same time that it does in Apple and other services. Beyond that, I do need to do more stuff with the YouTube channel, but as far as the episodes just appearing, it does work. So it's been a bit of a bear. So I'm going to take a break on that because honestly, it slowed down other stuff that I need to be doing for the show. So that's where that lands. Big news. Thaleo, the Madbotter Thaleo Earth Day Challenge is open again, accepting submissions from U.S. middle and high school students until Earth Day itself. So that's the cutoff, right? The end of the day on Earth Day. The grand prize is a Thaleo provided by me, right? By the Madbotter. And Launch MSP, Brandon over there, jumped into the fray and is offering a launch keyboard to the second and third prize winners. There's a launch and a launch light, I believe, available. So good stuff. The first time we're ever actually going to have a runner-up and second runner-up prize. Again, you have to be a U.S. high school or middle school student. You need to send in some sort of parental permission. It could be as simple as, like, you know, a parent or guardian writing an email or signing a letter and scanning it. No big deal. There'll be a link in the show notes to how to submit a project. The project, your entry, all it has to be is anything that would, you know, broadly help with the planet and global warming and all that good stuff. Needs to be publicly available on GitHub, and you need to send that and a brief explanation and an introduction to yourself to the email that is in the post linked in the show notes. So you can go ahead to alice.dev.blog for more information, or you could go to the correct website, which is in the show notes, which I think is dominicm.com. Either way, you'll find it, because I think it's in both places. So, all right, here's where we are, housekeeping-wise. Google stuff took a lot longer and a lot more effort than I had hoped it would, which has delayed a bunch of other things. Probably not going to be doing live shows just yet. We do have a good amount of interviews scheduled. Unfortunately, when working with people to do these interviews, you have to work with their time zone, their availability, yada, yada, yada. So having a set live time would be tough if we wanted the interviews to be live. Beyond that, I am working on new swag. I think the first thing that's going to come out is going to be either a t-shirt or some sort of beverage container. I'm shopping around for rates. I am aware that a number of you, a larger number than I had originally thought, are in Europe. So I'm trying to find a vendor that will, without it being, you know, bank breaking, right, ship to Europe. That hopefully will be good to go in that shipping out in June, I hope. Yeah, so that should be fun. Brand new designs, all good stuff. There will not be robes. Don't ask. No robes. The robes were a nightmare. Poor Chris dealing with all those robes. It was just terrible. It's fun. It was unique. But I've been thinking about like gaming-oriented thing or like practical things. I don't know. It's surprising. I would like to deal with one vendor, and it's surprisingly hard to find one that can do more than just coffee mug, t-shirt. What do you call this? They're popular, right? The soccer moms like them. The metal, you know what I'm talking about. The metal, like they get for hot and cold beverages for your car, right? With the lid. I have Stanley. Is Stanley? Maybe Stanley cups. So that's all that. Our quick hit game review this week, Civ 7. I have been playing a productivity killing amount of it, kind of. I've been playing quite a lot. I have some very mixed feelings. It is a fun game. It is not what I was hoping for. One of the reasons I enjoy those games, and I think a lot of you do just based on our Discord chats, is the, you know, historical aspect of it. There's something strange about having Harriet Tubman invade your civilization, you know, with her Japanese army or something, right? It's the way this game works, where it lets you pick a leader that persists while your civilization changes, is odd. I also feel that they've lost. Can I put this? I feel like it wasn't done, I guess is what I'm trying to say, right? It has been patched. It is a little better, but originally the UI was pretty buggy on my experience. At least I'm playing on Mac OS, on Apple Silicon, on a ridiculously over-specced machine for this game. And I was still having strange UI glitches. It has gotten better. Online play does seem to work pretty well, at least my experience. I mostly play offline for obvious reasons. The game's long as hell. So that's where I am. If you are interested, because I know there were folks in the Discord a few weeks ago, myself included, talking about getting a Civ game together, Civ 6 is probably the best way to go, or Civ 5. The nice thing is those games right now are super cheap if you don't have them. You can get like all the expansions and all the DLC, etc. I think you could buy in for like $20. So really good. Other gaming news, Star Wars Unlimited, the card game, has a new expansion called Jump to Lightspeed. And the only reason I'm mentioning this is, where is my Gungan Jar Jar themed expansion, huh? Why is it not here? Misa looking for it, but it's not there. It's focused on vehicles, looks super fun. I'm supposed to be playing it later today, so we'll see. Okay, I won't hold you any longer to get to the good stuff. Please join the Discord. That is the primary channel for feedback, etc. A lot of cool people in there, a lot of people getting games, a lot of people helping with tech support, development, all that good stuff. Also, I'm going to be opening up the mailbag probably by the time you hear this, the end of that week for March's end of month feedback episode. So if you have feedback that you want read on the show, go ahead and put that there. I already did get a few anonymous feedbacks regarding a few things we discussed on the show, so I will put that in there too. You know who you are, who work at certain companies that sent me stuff. And yeah, so here's Nick Proud, MVP, a Brit, author of Minimal APIs and ASP.NET 9, which that is a very long title, but I started reading the book. It well written, seems good. If you're a .NET guy or interested in getting to .NET, go ahead. It seems like something you'd want to see. And again, the CTO at Nexbotics. All right, have a great day. Talk to you soon. I'm here with Nick Proud of Nexbotics. He's over in just outside of London, I believe, right?
Sorry, no, I'm near Manchester, so I'm a bit more up north, unfortunately.
It was why I'm, why I refuse to acknowledge that. Did I hear Chelsea? Chelsea?
Yeah, I mean, the whole country is basically London, and I'm currently drinking a large cup of British tea.
well, you know, all of America is now Florida, which is where I am. So, you know, it's a strange kind of reverse conquering situation over here, but yeah. So I guess the obvious question is, what is Nexbotics?
Yeah, so Nexbotics is an intelligent automation company. So if you think about if you've ever come across RPA, like robotic process automation, I know you will have done, Mike, but if we think companies like UiPath and Automation Anywhere, they're companies that are looking to automate manual processes. And I think we've gone into the next stage of evolution with that, with intelligent automation and with AI, as crazy as everything is with AI at the moment. Automation is kind of, it's a given that it needs some kind of AI decision making. And we're doing a lot with data extraction, invoice processing, and still that RPA element where you're clicking things on a screen or you're typing into a web form and all that good stuff. But essentially taking things that humans do, but the repetitive actions that are kind of monotonous, frankly, and automating those away, enhancing it with AI. And then we have a platform called Naya, which is the Nexbotics Intelligent Automation Hub, which just rolls off the tongue, I know. And that is a way of facilitating human in the loop for automation. So we're kind of working on this philosophy that most things can be automated as long as you appreciate that humans are still critical to that automation process. And the platform facilitates that. It allows humans to come in at the times that they're needed and to not have the automation completely dependent on them, essentially.
Interesting. Okay. So I think just for folks who don't know, kind of plain old classic vanilla RPA is literally the computer is piloting the application, right? So it's actually, if you're familiar with Selenium at all, any kind of UI testing like that, it's basically doing that. And it sounds like you're taking that a step further.
Yeah, definitely. So we actually started out being very much an RPA, you know, software house. We would go into businesses and we would say, okay, we can take this process that is basically spreadsheets or working in a desktop application, and we can get an RPA bot that can open the spreadsheet and look at the cells and then move that data into a website or something like that. And that was nothing new when we first started. But as we started to get into AI-enhanced OCR, the optical character recognition, so reading documents, and then realizing that, you know, we can actually cover off a lot of use cases if we just make it possible for humans to come in and validate or assist a bot, then we actually start to move away from RPA. And we actually use a lot of C-sharp based stuff now. We essentially splitting a lot of processes up into chunks and saying, okay, well, if there's no UI automation in this part of the process, then there's no reason to use these low-code studios like UiPath, or we were even using a lot of Python-based stuff like Robot Framework for a while, which is a bit more obscure, but it's a more of a test automation platform. But now we've got a very sort of microservices-influenced architecture for a lot of these automations, where you just have a bunch of worker services which are responsible for their bit, and Naya is able to interface with them and get telemetry, and they're able to, you know, pass things back to Naya for human intervention. And then if we do need some UI automation, then we can still do that, because one of those phases can just be, you know, Robot Framework or UiPath, Selenium, wherever it needs to be.
Very cool. You mentioned C#. Are you running this on are these individual services, like individual ASP apps, or?
So they're more akin to what we used to call background workers. For example, if I take like an invoice processing process, we can split that into several different chunks. The first one being go into Outlook, fetch the email, strip the attachments, and then log each of those attachments as a job in Naya. And then we've got another service which dequeues from Naya, and it's the same job, but it's got information that says, hey, there's a file in this location, pass that to Azure Document Intelligence, which is the AI-assisted OCR we use. And then that returns JSON, which describes the document, got all the invoice fields, the line items, and we can pass it on to the next worker service, which is going to do some validation. So, for example, if it was pulling data from NetSuite and saying, yep, there's the PO, I'll match the data with that PO that I've extracted. And then if it can't use the NetSuite API, because that might happen, there might be a stipulation from the customer side, for example, then we can just pass it to another phase that dequeues a job. And then that will be an RPA process. And that will say, right, I'll open up NetSuite, I'll log in, etc.
Interesting. Now, I know you're running a bunch of different workers, right? You're running a bunch of different ones. Are you using any of like the new, like I read your article, you know, C# for automation. Are you using any of like the ML.NET stuff, any of the kind of the new hotness, or is it more of a classic custom implementation?
It's a bit of a mix, really. I mean, the ML.NET stuff is being used for classification. So we do have some use cases where we want to be able to determine the best route for something that's come through. Because, I mean, let's face it, most of the automations we're working on are document-based. So the benefit of something like ML.NET is that we can build a model that says, you know, I can just have one service which decides or sort of triages all of these documents that are coming through. And while we might have multiple processes for different use cases, you could just have this more holistic ML.NET service which decides which process to distribute to. So for cases where we're trying to decide what sort of tunnel to send things down, ML.NET is really good. I'd say the bulk of the AI stuff we've been using over the past few years is still the Document Intelligence Suite, which it's pretty amazing, really. You know, the pre-built models they've got for things like invoicing and contracts, you know, you don't have to do any training. You can just pass the document to it and it instantly knows what to look for. But we have started to build one of these reusable services that interfaces with OpenAI. It's just not avoidable, really. We've got to do something with Gen AI. And more recently, we found that the accuracy was actually higher when we did a little bit of prompt engineering, passing a document to the OpenAI API. And so that's where we're kind of heading at this point. It's definitely becoming a mix of traditional software development plus prompt engineering.
Yeah, I was wondering if you guys were using OpenAI. We ended up doing the same thing just because I don't know how you feel about it, but their API is one of the better ones I've seen in a long time.
Mm. Yeah, it is very intuitive. I'll give it that. Yeah. I mean, I do have a few bugbears around the fact that I might be doing it wrong, but I think we've been spinning up new assistants for making requests against different documents, which, you know, that might be wrong. It doesn't seem right. There's a bit of overhead there, but yeah. We have seen, you know, if you've got large documents as well, there's a lot of timeouts and things like that. But these are all little kinks that you can iron out over time.
Okay, so let's take a step back. You have all these different workers running. They're .NET workers. Are they generally running in like containers on one instance per customer, or is this more of a cloud offering, meaning like a SaaS?
Yeah, so we have some initial like professional service work up front, and we're trying to reduce that by making a lot of these services as repeatable as possible. So some of those examples I had around fetching emails, interfacing with OCR, picking up files, those are now pretty much off the shelf. And so we can have an element of turnkey implementation there, which is really good. Because, you know, we don't really want to be charging lots of high professional service fees. No one likes that. But in terms of the hosting implementation, most of our customers are on Windows, and they're used to having these services running in the background. So we often deploy the workers as Windows services. There is the odd exception when a customer will say, hey, we've got a Linux VM or a Linux server somewhere. And in that case, it's very easy to deploy something as a Docker container. But ultimately, either method works, really. They're just an isolated worker that has one job. And it's almost like we're trying to apply the solid principles to an automation process, which I think is pretty cool.
Oh, that is really cool. That's super interesting. Yeah, I could see how that works. Since you have like a machine that's running, you know, applications ABC, you would deploy, and correct me if I'm wrong, right? I'm trying to understand how this would work. You would deploy the three Windows services, you know, for A, B, and C respectively, and just run them on that machine. You're correct, or?
Yeah. And essentially what happens then is that the VM that the service lives on becomes known as the bot. So, you know, you might have the VM, which has the you know, Graph API service, which is just constantly pulling emails down and queuing them up as jobs for Naya. And people will refer to that as the email bot, because they know that its job is just to get emails. But on top of that, you know, you've got Naya being the orchestrator, being that thing that's sort of all-knowing and the sort of single sense of truth, regardless of which service is being used.
Oh, that's super interesting. So do you ever run into an issue in the cases where a customer or client, whatever, does have a non-Windows machine they need to target? Is that kind of where the professional services side comes in, where you just have to write like a custom thing, or how does that work?
I'd say it depends on the systems they need us to work with. I think in the early days, it definitely was the case that if you said, okay, we've got this legacy Java application, then, you know, the developer's teeth would start to chatter, because it'd be like, okay, how the hell am I going to get this automated? I don't have any
springs and struts, the good old days.
Yeah. Oh God, PTSD is already kicking in. But I mean, it's a lot easier now, actually, largely thanks to Robot Framework, which I definitely encourage people to take a look at if they haven't already, because it doesn't seem to be that well known. I think it came out of Finland. I think Nokia developed it.
It's a poor sweet Nokia.
Yeah. it's a Python-based test automation framework that then, there was a company that they've been bought now, but they were called Robocorp. I'm sure you've come across them.
Yep.
They essentially built their platform on Robot Framework, and I think they've gone full Python now. But it's a sort of semi-low-code framework that is really good at things like image recognition. So we've actually pivoted away, even for Windows applications, from trying to dig into selectors inside, you know, Win32 namespace, and just, you know, copying, you know, taking a screenshot and saying, hey, this is the button, go click it. And I know UiPath has been doing that for a while, but for us, that was a massive accelerator, because UI automation is painful. And so
horrible.
It is disgusting. It's really painful. So we just try to limit that now to only the places where it's absolutely necessary. And then even then, if we can use something generic like an image, then it's beautiful, because it means most of the time screen resolution isn't an issue. You know, we've learned a lot of lessons, I think, from UI automation, things like RDP. You know, customers will give us RDP access, and then as soon as we log out, we've lost a session, and the UI automation needs a human session, like a user session. So, you know, transferring to things like VNC, for example. There's so many different lessons that we've learned, but I think the biggest lesson for us is to avoid UI automation wherever possible. And so that was what informed this huge pivot to, you know, C# wherever we can, basically.
Yes, that's interesting. You've mentioned a couple Python tools and that your guys are in .NET. So I should probably have opened it. You're a Microsoft MVP, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Now, I always forget how that works. Are you like a certain kind? Isn't there like schools of MVPs or categories or something?
Yeah. So you do have a different category. So I'm an MVP for developer technologies, which basically means, you know, C#, .NET, really. But you can have MVPs for Azure specifically, or even for Office platforms. I believe there's one for like CRM as well, or SQL. There's quite a few different categories. It essentially just means that you're recognized as someone who contributes knowledge to the community, whether that is podcasts like this or YouTube videos, which was the main reason for me. I recently wrote a book. I'm starting to shamelessly plug, not even halfway through the show now.
Oh, but, plug the book. I didn't even know that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I recently wrote a book on minimal APIs. All those things, yeah, they contribute to the MVP status. And you have to be nominated, but you know, you essentially get nominated. You see the evidence of the community contributions, and then you get awarded this year long status, and it's quite nice to have a little trophy, and you do get some perks as well, some free software, which is really good. And then as long as you're continuing to contribute, you get renewed each year. And I think there are similar programs for Java and some other technologies.
Well, actually, now you just go to happy hour at Larry Ellison's. That's it. For the Java, for the Oracle version, you just have happy hour at Larry Ellison's.
Okay.
Joking. Don't sue me, Larry. I'm very litigious. So question. Okay, a lot of people who listen to the show are kind of more junior, right? They they all have some, I would call them app ideas, but that's the corruption of me coming from the Apple world. Let's say project ideas, and literally once a year I answer the most common questions, get over and over again, and it's, I want to start insert new projects here. What should I write it in? Now there are some cases where, you know, obviously some tools are very clearly the wrong tool for the job, right? Like I don't know that I'd recommend, you know, Ruby for your performant game that you need to write.
Yeah, but we haven't started writing automations in Rust yet, despite the recent news blast of just Rust everywhere.
I wouldn't say that, because if the Rust evangelists hear you,
I know. I'm taking my life into my own hands.
They are very vocal and very well, evangelical is just the right word. They truly are. They truly believe they are saving the world from the great sin of memory issues.
I know,
safety.
It's actually really entertaining at the moment, like watching I know we're completely veering off, but sure. You know, watching the message boards for the Linux kernel and seeing, you know, the conversations between the C group and the Rust group. And I mean, yeah, it's really entertaining to see that stuff at the moment.
It's one of the more common things we get sent into the show, I will say, the Rust, because there's always, you know, what was it last week as of the recording, the Linus Torvalds kind of just went after somebody from, I forgot the guy's name, but one of the Rust guys. It's certainly, I don't know, it's a whole, you know, it's funny because I'm supposed to have a kind of a very prominent Rust evangelist on in the coming months. Mm. And it's tough to, you know, they're right? There is a ton of value, a ton of reasons that where you might be writing C or C, in particular C++. I actually think going after the C guys is a mistake. I think where most of the issues, if you look at some of the security issues we've had over, let's say, the last 5 years, they've almost all been C++.
Yeah.
In terms of programming language related, right? But, it's one of those flies, you get more flies with honey than vinegar situations. I think the militant, you know, you're going to destroy the world with some sort of memory issue and you're a bad person if you're not converting to Rust, it is not going to get you very far.
No, and I think it probably would have happened by now, wouldn't it? If we're saying that, you know, writing stuff in C is such a massive risk. I think there's something there's definitely something in that, but I don't think it's as catastrophic as people say. And like I say, if there was something incredibly dangerous about what people are doing in the Linux kernel specifically in C, then yeah, we would have seen it. But at the same time, I hope people stay open-minded about the evolution of the kernel as people, you know, get older and move on. And so yeah, I mean, obviously we've veered a lot, but it's quite a fascinating thing to be a spectator in, because I don't write C, I don't write Rust, and I'm certainly not a Linux kernel developer, but it really is, it's on one side, it's really great seeing the passion because people really care, which is amazing. But on the other side, you want people to be as open-minded as possible, don't you?
Yeah, you want them to be open-minded. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, though, of, you know, we're going to need, if the Linux kernel, and I'm not a kernel developer by any means either, is going to stick with C, well, where is the mentorship and training of the next generation of, you know, kernel-level C developers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I see that as that nurturing of a community. Maybe I'm getting a lot of hate mail. It's certainly a rough and tumble, and it has to be, right? The Linux kernel runs so much of the world
in
a lot of ways that I understand the stakes. Well, anyway, that's a whole can of crabs and vipers and whatever the hell C is, you know, Lovecraftian old gods. So the question that we usually get in, just kind of rewinding a bit, is what do I write this in? And I think, you know, most people thinking RPA and RPA related automation stuff, myself included, would think Python, right? With maybe C++ backing for performance intensive stuff, or yes, Rust backing, you know, too. Why .NET? Was it just you're already an experienced .NET team, or?
That's definitely a part of it. And I think
makes sense.
Particularly in the UK, I do think that .NET's got quite a strong foothold over here. You know, I think that a lot of the, don't get me wrong, obviously Java is still an enterprise behemoth, but I think when we think about, you know, automating business processes, we're thinking about the enterprise, aren't we? And I do think that for starting out with an automation process, .NET is really well configured for, you know, for the corporate world in particular. And, you know, if you couple it with, as you mentioned, you know, ML.NET, all the services that are coming out of Azure, it really is it's a very, very holistic framework now. You know, ever since it went open source back when, what was it, .NET 5? You know, we moved out of framework into core. From core into .NET 5.
From core into framework, yep.
You know, it really has just sort of rocketed since then. And I kind of find that for starting out, it's a lot more friendly. You know, we're a very small company still, but we were, you know, minute when we first started. But if you think about all the tool sets that we can use in .NET without having to really shell out anything until we were in the cloud, and even then, you know, it's pretty cheap. I think when you think of enterprise on the other side and you think Java, you know, I just think that it's nowhere near as accessible. And I'm not really just talking about the syntax, you know, because obviously they're very similar languages. I know that people used to call C#, you know, Microsoft Java, but I do think that it is just generally more accessible. And some of the things that we talked about, like worker services, and then your ASP.NET, serverless even, you know, which supports .NET natively. We use all three of those things in our business, and they work very well cohesively to keep automations running. So yeah, I think, you know, practically it is, you know, coming from, yeah, the team, they're .NET. But I do think particularly in the UK, I can't really speak too much for the US, but I think .NET is becoming more of a go-to for this kind of work.
I could see it. I mean, it's very similar here, at least in the customers I deal with, where, you know, it's the old, what was it? Nobody gets fired for buying IBM. Nobody gets fired for buying .NET in the enterprise, right?
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
My product isn't based on .NET. It's based on, a little bit of Rust, guys. Just to stem the Twitter DMs.
Hey, if it works, it works.
You know, it is good. I know we've become a Rust half hour here, but it really is good. It's just, God damn, calm down. Like, take a break. Okay, so how does one get started thinking about, I'm a new developer, right? I'm brandy new out of college. I have dreams of being the next Blizzard Entertainment, because, you know, that's I think that's a pretty high percentage there.
it doesn't matter where I am, but I, you know, I've heard this podcast and I'm like, damn, that Nick guy, he's got it. I got to get into .NET. He's an MVP. Maybe I should pick up his book. Where do I go from there? What's my first move out of the gate?
There's a really good partnership that's just sprung up between FreeCodeCamp and Microsoft to offer a free certification in .NET, or in C# specifically. So it's the C# foundational certification. And it really is a nice and accessible entry point for people that just want to learn or play with C#. So I definitely recommend people start there. I'd be remiss if I didn't say, you know, YouTube is still a good source. And obviously having plenty of videos on there, then, you know, please do check those out. I do try to cater quite heavily to beginners because I know that, you know, being self-taught myself, you know, it's difficult. It is really hard to get into a new, not just a language, a new ecosystem, because .NET, I think, it's more than just C#. And, you know, books are falling out of favor, but as you become more experienced, I think if you're looking to specialize in certain areas, particularly with architecture in .NET, then I think that they're a good shout.
Excellent. I think that's all great advice. Yeah. What is one tool that you can't live without? Can't be Nexbotix, right? Because that's your own tool. That's what we do for everybody. Go fire away. It could be any tool, by the way. It could be a physical thing. It could be an open source project, a code thing, a proprietary thing. It could be your coffee machine for all I care.
Oh, well, yeah, the coffee machine is actually right. It is up there. My Nespresso machine. It is dear to my heart. But this is going to sound really, really tame and boring, but I think just the immediate window in Visual Studio or Rider, you know, just being able to test at runtime, like what is in that collection, what's in that JSON, and just type it in.
That's a great point.
Just the terminal at runtime while something's at a breakpoint. That's huge for me at the moment. And I know that's not really that exciting, but it's just, I couldn't live without it.
Oh, I remember not having one. It's pretty exciting. we call it something different in the Ruby Python-y world, but yeah, I'll take it.
So you don't have? Do you not have that? I mean, I'm not a Ruby developer, but you don't have that in Ruby.
We do. There's different ways to do it. We have a Rails console if you're doing Rails. There's also, well, I know it's in VS Code, but I tend to use RubyMine, which is the JetBrains equivalent of for Ruby, and it has the exact same thing. It can just be like, you know, let me crack open this array just to see, did I get all my, whatever it was, right? The invoices I'm looking for, whatever.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. All right. So we're going to have links to everything, to Nexbotix, to your book. Is your book available digitally on like Amazon or?
Yeah, it's published by Pact Publishing, but it's available on Amazon in the US and the UK. I believe in Europe as well.
Fantastic. And is there anywhere else you want to send the folks, Nick?
You know what? I think that's probably everywhere, actually. Maybe you can catch me on, I'm very rarely on Twitter or X, whatever we're calling it today, but I'm Nick Proud on there. And you can find me on LinkedIn as well. I tend to respond pretty quickly to people on LinkedIn as well.
Yes, and he has very good articles on C#.NET stuff, which is actually how I found you. So
it is indeed.
It is indeed. All right, Nick, have a great afternoon, I presume? 5 hours.
Yes, right? Afternoon for me, sunny afternoon.
All right, I'll talk to you later.
Cheers.
Cheers, bye.